Ladies and gentlemen, the George Wilder Jr. Show has now arrived. Chicago's finest internet radio show, making a world a better place, one show at a time.
Thank you.
The George Wilder Jr. Show is now on the air. Take it away, Dad.
All right. All right, welcome to the George Wilder Jr. Show on Block Talk Radio, broadcasting live. We're live this time, folks. I mean, we're broadcasting live out of the city of Chicago, and it's great. It's beautiful. The weather is beautiful. It's cold, but it's not as cold as it was a few weeks ago before Christmas. And as I've said yesterday on the show, I hope you guys had a great Christmas and looking forward to having an even better New Year. Wow, 2017. It still slips off my tongue. I mean, it's just phenomenal. I mean, 2017. Wow, the years are going by. Everybody's going to be another year older. Some people like that. Some people do not like that, but it's going to happen. Once again, welcome to the George Wilder Jr. Show, 347-857-1762. Happy 2016. Happy 2017. Oh, wow. I better get it off. You got to get used to saying it. You know, you really got to get used to saying 2017. Because we all been saying 2016 for a year. And now we just got to get used to saying 2017. It's going to take a few of us a little time. But eventually it'll come. You know, it'll come. My guest today is author Nicoline Amby. We're waiting for her to see if she's gonna, if it's a her. You know, you never know nowadays. you just get what you get, right? All righty. Happy holidays from everyone from the George Wilder Jr. Show. Follow me on Facebook. Follow me on, wow. I'm looking at a screen here, and I'm hearing about a television screen here, and all that they're doing is talking about more crime in the city of Chicago. And I haven't heard anything about them lowering the crime statistics for 2017 because they don't have any plan. They don't have anything. If you heard the show yesterday, then you know that I was pretty pissed off at the weekend crime, at the Christmas holiday crime. Instead of in their house celebrating Christmas with their family and friends, these assholes are out there shooting people in Chicago. You know, I'm pretty sure other places too, but, you know, I focus on Chicago because I'm from Chicago and I actually broadcast and live here. So, you know, I'm thinking, wow, why are these people shooting up each other on Christmas Eve and on Christmas Day and further on into the Christmas weekend? It's ridiculous. However, the police, like I said, they don't have a fucking clue on how to solve this, how to put this together. The politicians, they don't have a goddamn clue of what to do. In order to solve the problem in the city of Chicago, we need people who can solve problems because we do not have that right now. We have politicians. We have a superintendent. This guy is practically new. If you want to say new, he's been superintendent for maybe, I don't know, 6 or 7 months. I don't know if you can still say he's new or not, but he has no plans. He has no solutions for the ongoing crime. He has nothing. The only thing he knows how to do is get on television after 60 people have been shot and try to make up some excuse to why his guys cannot seem to solve these solvable crimes. I think they're solvable. You know, I mean, I really do. I just don't think these assholes putting enough effort into trying to solve these crimes. They have no plans. They have no solutions because if they did, they would, you know, they would let us know, the taxpayers. They would let the people know if they had plans on how to solve these crimes because we are responsible for their paycheck. So, you know, they would probably have to let us know. They don't have to, but, you know, it would be nice by them not letting us know how they're going to solve these crimes that's constantly going on. Tells me and tells other people that they don't have a plan. They don't have any solutions. They have reasons. The reason why the crime is being committed is because the gangbangers are shooting the gangbangers. And I said this on yesterday's show, last night's show. We don't need to hear things that we already know. We know that some of these bad guys get out of prison too early. Okay, we know that. The judicial system knows that. We know that some of this crime is caused by bad parenting. We know that. We know a lot of these crimes are committed by repeat gun offenders. We know this. We know that there's guns out here on the street. We know that. We know that there's gangbangers and thugs out here on the street that are shooting each other. And sometimes they miss and hit an innocent bystander or a child. We know all of this. What we do not know is that why in the hell can't you police officers solve this problem? This is a big fucking problem. I get so sick of hearing what I already know from some of these high politicians and the superintendent of police. And, you know what I'm saying? Get out here and solve some damn problems. Get out here and save some lives on the south and west sides of the city. And I've, on this show, I have given solution after solution in solving these problems. I think if I was mayor of the city of Chicago, this shit would not be happening because I would have a clear cut. Oh, damn. I can't even say it. I would have a clear plan I would bring the crime down in this city because I would have no incentive not to do that. The mayor keeps asking for solutions from the public. And that's all it is. It's just asking, hearing what people have to say. But they're not going to implement any of that. If they do implement it, they're going to take the credit for it, which I couldn't care less. You want to take the credit for something I tell you how to do, that's fine with me. As long as I know that I can walk down my neighborhood or my community without being attacked or shot. But this is crazy. I mean, these politicians and their superintendents, these assholes, bootlickers, as Spike Lee called them, these people aren't about crap. As long as there are 60 or 70 people getting shot in the city of Chicago every goddamn weekend, and we've got all these politicians and all of these cops out here on the street, body armor and video cameras all over every place, and they still can't seem to bring down the damn crime. What is it that tells you? One of the things that tells me is that we need new leadership. We need somebody in office that cares about these people on the south and west sides of the city in Chicago. These people don't give a damn. If they, you know what? I'm going to say this. If the mayor's children lived on the city, on the city's west sides and south sides, if the superintendent children, I'm talking about their children now, if their relatives, if the mayor and the superintendent and the governor's relatives, children, cousins, uncles, whatever, were living in a high crime community, do you think this would be happening? No. There would be policemen. If this was a governor's community on the city, on this city's west and south sides of the city, it would be so much goddamn police over there. It would be pathetic. Guarding this person's home or house or whatever or apartment. But the fact is that these are poor people, food stamps, welfare, whatever you want to call it, uneducated. They ain't going to do a goddamn thing. You know, they're going to let these people shoot each other. But if it was their relatives over there on the south and west sides of the city, the mayors and the governors, as I've got through saying, police would be everywhere. 24/7 on the spot. But since, you know, it's nothing but a bunch of low-life black people over there killing each other, what the hell? And the majority of the policemen on the force, I believe, are African Americans. Even they are afraid to go over there. It's just crazy, you know, I mean, that these people can't seem to lower the crime in the city of Chicago. If you think about it, New York, Los Angeles, they are larger cities than Chicago. Chicago is the third largest city, soon to be the fourth because people are leaving in droves. But in this case, right now, Chicago is the third largest city in America. The third, New York and Los Angeles, you know, they're larger. And New York and Los Angeles together have a lower crime rate than Chicago. Now, what are they doing as larger cities that Chicago is not doing? And it's a smaller city and it has more crime than those two larger cities. I'm getting passionate here, folks. It's just crazy. Oh, I hear things like, well, they have stricter gun laws than Chicago. There is no damn city throughout the United States that has more stricter laws than Chicago. So that's a bunch of BS, Mr. Police Superintendent. That's a bunch of BS. And even if it was true, that's no excuse for you guys not to get over on the west sides and south sides of the city and take down the bad guys. It's still, I mean, if I can say this, if the police superintendent and the mayor, you know, they can't get together on this. They just, you know what? These people are just hoodwinking the public. That's all they're doing. They are hoodwinking the people in the city of Chicago and the state of Illinois. You know, because I don't think that the superintendent of this of Chicago police, I don't think this guy's earning his paycheck. I don't think a lot of these police officers out here are earning their paychecks. Anytime there are 60 to 70 goddamn shootings every damn weekend in the city of Chicago, these guys are not earning their paychecks. Anytime that there's killers and murderers out here on the street that have not been caught yet, these guys are not earning their paycheck. Anytime these guys are not patrolling these goddamn neighborhoods like they should be, they're not earning their paycheck. Anytime these guys show up after a killing or a murder and stand around in droves after the murder has been committed, they are not earning their paychecks, as far as I'm concerned. I get so sick of it, tired of it. Every damn weekend, 60 to 100 people have been shot in the city of Chicago. And everybody's yelling, where is the police? Where the fuck is the police? Because if they were patrolling these areas, this would not be happening. If they were in these high crime areas 24/7, day, night, and whenever, day and night, all night, never leaving, this will never happen. This is called, if they don't know, this is called stopping crime before it happens. This is called being a deterrent to possible or for sure crime. That's what it's called, if they don't know. These police officers in the city of Chicago, when there's 60 people shot, 100 people shot during the weekend, they're not deterring crime. They're not preventing it because they are nowhere near it to stop it. They're nowhere near it to prevent it. You want to stop crime? You better get over there where it is and try to prevent it. You are a deterrent. That uniform is a deterrent against crime. People will see that uniform and they will fly. They will not do what they set out to do. Now, I cannot speak for those assholes out here that may shoot a cop. All I'm saying is that the crime in the city of Chicago is pathetic. And it's a damn shame that our leaders, the mayor, the governor, the police superintendent, seems to be letting this shit happen while throwing bones or tidbits of information out there to the public, and we're supposed to eat it up. We're supposed to believe them that they have the right, that they're doing the right thing by actually doing nothing. However, they can go pick up those paychecks. You're getting paid to stop crime. You're getting paid to fight crime. You're getting paid to deter crime. And that is just not happening. They are trying to blame the community. What a community. They won't say anything. They have a code of silence in the community. Fuck. The police themselves have a code of silence. A code of silence should not prevent a cop from doing his or her job. You have to work around that code of silence. If you can't break that code of silence, then you should have things in place to work around that code of silence to get the bad guys out of the neighborhood, to deter the crime, to bring down the shootings in some of these neighborhoods and some of these areas. Not only shootings that go on in the city of Chicago, we have muggings, we have robbings. This has got to stop too. You know, I think some of the trains, the public trains, the CTA trains, Chicago Transit Authority, I think they should have more people on that train than the person who is the conductor who is driving the train. He's the only guy on the train. That's why the bad guys, you know, they know this. The bad guys know that. And that's why they are getting on the trains and robbing people, because they know that there's no one on them. Yeah, you got cameras. That's overhead cameras. You can see them all you want to. You can see them, get a good look at them. But that camera does not mean that you're going to catch them. You know, because a lot of these guys be wearing disguises. And I say this again, as long as you don't catch these bad guys, you don't apprehend them, you don't lock them up, they're out here to do it again and again and again and again. Once again, the police is not doing their jobs, bringing down the shootings in the city of Chicago, the robbings, the muggings. You can't walk down the goddamn street. You can't even go to the park. Afraid you're going to get mugged in the park. Every now and then, I'll see the police patrolling in the park, but that's like every now and then. These places like this, these public places like the park and all this kind of thing, should have a 24-hour police presence. That's a good way of deterring crime. Okay, you said, well, we don't have that many police officers. We don't have the manpower. You've just hired 1,000 cops. What are you going to do with them? And I'm going to say this again. Hiring more cops is not going to solve the problem. Hiring more police officers is not going to solve the problem if you don't have a plan and a solution to bringing down the crime rates in the city of Chicago or anywhere. Why throw more money at a problem if you don't have a plan? It's nutty. It's crazy. All right, you've been listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show. I get passionate, folks, on some of these issues. Follow me on Facebook. Follow me on on Blog Talk Radio. Follow me right here. And once again, have a safe and wonderful 2017. Okay, what it says here. Happy holidays, everyone, from the George Wilder Jr. Show. The talk of the time, the talk of our times. And we're going into 2017. It just seems so. It seems so interesting. It's, you know, and it's going to be great. I got a feeling 2017 is going to be a great year, and I hope it does. And I hope it's a great year for you, and it's going to be a great year for the George Wilder Jr. Show also. All right, Chicago crime. We just got through talking about that. I mean, I can talk about Chicago crime or crime in general for the remainder of the show, but I know I'm not going to do that. I will probably bring it up again sometime later on into the show. All right, Carrie Fisher. We know that she died a couple of days ago. But now her mother, Debbie Reynolds, has been rushed to the hospital. So, you know, her mother. So it's just an ongoing thing for this family, you know, daughter, now the mother, you know. Who knows? I actually thought that Carrie Fisher was going to pull out of it. You know, I can't, because her mother was on Twitter and on social media saying that she was okay, so to speak. Then suddenly the next day we hear that Carrie Fisher died. And I'm hearing that she actually finished a movie, another Star Wars movie that's going to be coming out next year. She finished it. And they say she's got an even bigger part in this movie than she had in the 2016 movie, Star Wars, The Force Awakens. So now she's got a bigger part in, I think, but it's Star Wars 8 or something. Okay, but anyway, Debbie Reynolds, I remember watching Debbie Reynolds in those musicals, especially Singing in the Rain. I thought she was cute. But now she's 84. She's 84. And they say she's in the hospital and somehow she wasn't breathing or something. It could be, this could be a, she could be suffering from the loss of her daughter, you know, from the death of her daughter. Sometimes this kind of thing happens, you know, a child dies, a loving child dies. suddenly this affects the one of the parents. This has happened before. So, but anyway, I'm wishing her a speedy recovery, and I hope she doesn't end up like her daughter. But you know, you never know. She may want to go wherever she thinks her daughter Carrie is in death. You never know. Debbie could have forced this on herself. She could say, "I don't want to live anymore because of my daughter's death." But maybe I'm wrong. I hope I'm wrong. But you never know. So Debbie Reynolds, the mother of the late Carrie Fisher, is being hospitalized. And we and they do not know any more than that. All right, you've been listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show. We're going to take a little musical break right here, folks, and we will be right back. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for listening. Here we go. All right, the news is that Carrie Fisher, mother, Debbie Reynolds, sorry about that, suffered a stroke. I mean, that just came in over the wires, folks. She suffered a stroke, and she was rushed to the hospital. That's according to TMZ. I don't like to quote TMZ because I really don't watch it or pay attention to any of it. But anyway, it's right here on the... online saying that Carrie Fisher's mother, legendary actress Debbie Reynolds, reportedly suffered a stroke One day after Carrie Fisher's death, after her daughter's death, it had to have something to do with her death, because it seems like here, I'm looking at some photographs, and it seems like the two were really close. It seemed like they were really, really close. And let's just hope the best for her. Anytime you suffer a stroke, it's not good. It really isn't. And now they're saying a possible stroke. First they say stroke, and then now they're saying possible stroke. This is why I just got through saying, folks, I got to wait until the real news comes in, because we don't know what's going on. I'm just reporting what they're reporting, okay? So we're going to find out. But it seems as though she actually has been rushed to the hospital. And I want to say again, I just hope that everything is okay and fine, and that she, you know, actually did not have a stroke, because strokes are, you know, they are bad, especially if they're severe. You can have light strokes, or, you know, it's just severe, especially if you're up there in age. A stroke can actually take your life. So you don't want that. You don't want that. All right. You've been listening to George Wilder Jr. Show. Follow me on Facebook, Black Talk Radio. Follow me right here. Follow me all over the place. And Happy New Year, everybody, and all that good stuff. And there is another piece of news that kind of, I think I should mention. Delivery trucks, FedEx, UPS, the United States Post Office. These trucks are being stolen with gifts inside. Wow. I mean, and they're being stolen. And then you find them later, you find the trucks later, the back door is busted open and all the gifts are gone. The thieves are just, I mean, these guys are just bolden. They steal your package. They'll come into your building. If you're getting packages and stuff like that, they will take your packages. You know, this is why I say, for the FedEx people who deliver my packages, you deliver a package here for me or for my family, you make sure you ring the bell. Don't just leave it sitting outside my door or out downstairs in the lobby or someplace. It has to be sitting. You have to ring the bell. Put it that way. You have to ring my bell, because I know we live in a pretty decent neighborhood, but still and all, you never know when crime can happen. The best person, the nicest person, can become a thief if they see something that they can just take that doesn't belong to them, you know. So we want to keep those people on the up and up. All right. So delivery trucks, I call them delivery truck robbers, you know, FedEx, post office, especially during the holiday, you know, people are ordering like hell online, you know, buying stuff online instead of going actually into the stores. They're doing it online, which is cool, because I do it online too. But, you know, the packages come, you know, whenever I order a package and I follow its path, tracking data, and I actually look for my packages, because I try to get to my package before the bad guy does. You know, like I said, we live in a pretty decent neighborhood. It doesn't happen all the time here, at least as much as I know right now, you know, but I'm just saying, but it doesn't hurt to be cautious. It doesn't hurt to be vigilant, especially when you're ordering something like a computer or maybe a mixer or something, whatever you're ordering, that's okay. But whatever you order, make sure you watch out for it. Make sure you are attentive to when your order is supposed to arrive at your door, you know. But if you're at home, you know, have these guys, delivery guys, ring your bell, give them your phone numbers, so they can let you know that they're outside of your door with your package. I don't think a package should never, ever be left outside your door, on your porch, in front of your house, thrown over the fence onto your lawn. I don't think that should happen, you know. So, but it does. It does. All right. You've been listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show. We're about making the world a better place if we can, but we cannot do it without you. We cannot make the world a better place without you. Once again, you guys out there, you have a safe and wonderful 2017. The Talk About Times, the George Wilder Jr. Show, is going into This show is going into 2017 on a high note, and I want to thank everybody out there for that, because if it wasn't for you, the George Wilder Jr. Show would not be on the air. I would be off doing something else, but you've kept me on the air. You surely have, because of your input, your feedback, your positive input, your positive feedback. And we're going to be going into 2017 because this show is all about making the world a better place. It's about motivating people who are not motivated, or motivating people who need to be motivated. I had a guest on the show a few days ago. We were talking about motivating people because there's a lot of people out here who are not motivated to do anything, and they like it. You're going to end up like Carrie Fisher if you don't motivate yourself and go out and get what you, they said, I believe something here said that Carrie Fisher was bipolar and that she was experiencing, or she had experienced with drugs or something. I don't know, folks. I'm just like you are. I'm hearing things and I'm just reporting them on the radio. But sometimes, things like this you hear can be true. But anyway, I'm just hoping that Debbie Reynolds, Carrie Fisher's mom, does not leave us like her daughter has. Wow. All right, you've been listening to George Wilder Jr. Show. We will be right back, folks. We're going to do this.
Do blacks commit more crimes than other races? The simple answer to this question is yes. The black population of the United States is approximately 13%, and the white population is approximately 62%. These are the FBI crime statistics for 2014, where blacks accounted for 27.8% of the total amount of arrests for that year, an obviously disproportionate amount for a population of 13%. The overall level of arrests for black people is higher than might be expected in almost every category, except for driving under the influence of alcohol. Black people accounted for most of the arrests for murder, 51.3%, robbery, 55.9%, and gambling, 58.9%. They were also significantly above average in several other categories. Weapons crimes, 40.7%, prostitution and commercialized vice, 41.8%, and aggravated assault, 33.1%. A common criticism of these figures is that they are based on arrests by police officers who may be disproportionately targeting black neighborhoods due to racial bias or profiling. However, these statistics seem to be corroborated by the National Crime Victimization Surveys, performed by the Department of Justice. The latest NCVS data is from 2008, and is collected by a random survey of 90,000 households. Blacks are consistently disproportionately represented in these surveys, correlating closely with the arrest figures. In addition to this, the number of black police officers has remained steady since 2007 at 12%, while being 13% of the population. There has been a marked rise in non-black ethnic minority officers, but despite police efforts, recruiting blacks into the police force has been challenging due to criminal background checks and a cultural attitude towards the police as an institution. Naturally, murder and non-negligent manslaughter is the category missing from the National Crime Victimization Survey, and it is also the most focused on by the media. Homicides by victim and perpetrator are often presented as percentages as victim and perpetrator by race, which gives a chart that looks like this. Most murders are committed by a perpetrator of the same race as the victim. This obfuscates the severity of the problem by making the number of murders look evenly spread between both racial categories, with a small crossover of black-on-white or white-on-black crime. However, displaying the number of murders brings the issue of disproportionate violence committed by black people into focus. When someone says, "Black lives don't matter to Black Lives Matter," this is what they mean. Black men are responsible for murdering other black men at a rate that is near parity with the murders of white men by other white men, when white men are 5 times as numerous as black men. These murders are usually committed with a handgun. So the question becomes, why? As Aristotle said in Politics, poverty is the parent of revolution and crime. There are many studies that positively correlate poverty with non-violent and violent crime, but I've chosen to use the Edinburgh Study of Youth Transitions and Crime performed by researchers from the University of Edinburgh. I've used this study because the black population of Edinburgh is approximately 1%, and the United Kingdom is a modern, industrialized, English-speaking, Christian heritage, first world democracy. This study has been done predominantly on white British people, and I want to showcase this to demonstrate that poverty has a distinct effect on people regardless of any inherent biological differences, and to remove the possibility that these results are due to racial discrimination. The Edinburgh study followed the lives of around 4,000 young people as they made the transition from childhood to adulthood, using both self-reported data from the young people themselves and linked data from a range of official sources. The researchers studied the effect of childhood poverty on violence in the teenage years, and examined its impact beyond into early adulthood. The researchers have set out 4 measures of poverty: socioeconomic status of the head of the household, whether the young person was not in education, training, or employment at age 18, whether the young person has been unemployed for more than a year at age 22, neighborhood deprivation based on census measures of poverty in the young person's area of residence. The study found that poverty had a significant and direct effect on young people's likelihood to engage in violence at age 15, even after controlling for the effects of a range of other factors known to influence violent behavior, even when taking into account of a raft of risk indicators that would be expected to increase the propensity to engage in violence, including poor family functioning, the lack of attachment to school, substance misuse, and impulsivity, and a range of protective factors that are known to act as preventatives, such as a strong and positive relationship with the parents. Young people who were living in a family where the head of the household was unemployed or in low-status manual employment, and those who were growing up in communities with high levels of deprivation, were significantly more likely to engage in violence. Household poverty appears to act as an exacerbating factor and increases the chance of such young people offending. The Edinburgh study provides evidence that children living in poverty are overrepresented among violent offenders. Even taking account of this increased risk of offending, however, children from poor backgrounds are disproportionately selected into the juvenile justice system and retained there by decision-making that is based on, amongst other things, their impoverished status. Previous work has shown that this type of systemic processing labels and marginalizes the most vulnerable young people in society, making it difficult for them to move on from offending as they mature. The system causes structural failures that prevent those in poverty from moving out of this condition, and in the longer term, this constrains opportunities and reduces life chances. As Aristotle recognized more than 2,000 years ago, poverty breeds criminal behavior. The Edinburgh study came to an interesting conclusion as to why this behavior would involve violence. For most young people, from the most impoverished backgrounds, violence provides a touchstone against which identities are honed. More particularly, violence empowers and is a means of attaining and sustaining status among peers. Willingness to use violence, therefore, becomes a resource for the most dispossessed, and this becomes a persistent feature throughout the teenage years. It follows that poverty will create increased levels of non-violent crime, such as theft, burglary, or drug dealing. But in the absence of available wealth as a status symbol, impoverished young people use capacity for violence instead. According to Pew Research Center data from 2013, black children are 27.3% of the black population, but 38.4% of those living in poverty. US Census Bureau data from 2014 shows that while overall 18% of families in the US with children under 18 live in poverty, this number rises to 32.1% for black families. The poverty rate for black families with intact marriages drops to 10.8%, but rises dramatically in cases of unmarried single parents. 31.2% of single fathers with children under 18 are impoverished, as are 46.1% of single mothers with children under 18. These figures follow the trend of economic hardship for single parents throughout the rest of the United States, albeit slightly more exaggerated. This has resulted in the black children living in poverty outnumbering white children living in poverty, in spite of white children outnumbering black children by 3-1. US Census Bureau data shows that over half of black children do not live with their biological fathers. Unmarried black mothers with children under 18 are the most impoverished demographic in American society, and they are the most common type of family structure in black communities. A 2005 study from the University of California called The Effects of Poverty and Economic Hardship Across the Generations found that economic pressure appears to be the key mechanism linking hardship to a cascade of effects on children's development. The distress caused by poverty seems to predict lower positive, i.e. self-confidence, good school performance, supportive relationship with peers, and higher negative child outcomes, i.e. antisocial behavior, depressed mood, and symptoms of anxiety. In contrast, higher family income and the investment in children's development appear to have beneficial influences on long-term developmental success. Taken together, the family stress model and investment model suggest an intergenerational transmission of poverty and economic hardship. The family stress model of economic hardship proposes that financial difficulties have an adverse effect on parents' emotions, behaviors, and relationships, which affect their parenting or socialization strategies. According to the model, the emotional distress of poverty predicts conflict and reduces warmth and support in parent-child relationships. These relationship disruptions contribute to children's emotional and behavioral problems, academic failures, and poor cognitive functioning. The investment model suggests that economic resources increase the investment parents are able to make in their children's development, promoting academic and social competencies. With increased resources, parents are able to invest in the development of their children, providing the special care, time, and services necessary to support their children's emotional needs. These investments contribute to enriched learning environments, higher standards of living, and safer homes and neighborhoods. Greater family resources appear to reduce risks associated with the stress of poverty and help create environments that promote competent development. Instability is another key factor in the emotional well-being and intellectual growth of a child. A 2013 study called The Negative Effects of Instability on Child Development, a Research Synthesis, describes the effects of poverty and instability. Children thrive in stable and nurturing environments where they have a routine and know what to expect. Although some change in children's lives is normal and anticipated, sudden and dramatic disruptions can be extremely stressful and affect children's feeling of security. Within the context of supportive relationships with adults who act as a buffer against any negative effects of instability, children learn how to cope with adversity, adapt to their surroundings, and regulate their emotions. When parents lack choice or control over change, they may be less likely to support their children in adapting to the change. Unbuffered stress that escalates to extreme levels can be detrimental to children's mental health and cognitive functioning. The experience of economic instability causes increased material hardship, particularly when families lack personal assets. Low family income negatively affects children's social, emotional, cognitive, and academic outcomes, even after controlling for parental characteristics. Children's cognitive development during early childhood is most sensitive to the experience of low family income. Parental employment instability is linked to negative academic outcomes, such as grade retention, lower educational attainment, and internalized and externalizing behaviors. The effect on grade retention is strongest for children with parents in a high school education or less, whereas the effect on educational attainment is stronger for blacks than whites, males, and firstborn children. In dual-income households, the father's job loss might be more strongly related to children's academic outcomes than the mother's job loss. Job instability leads to worse child behavioral outcomes than when a parent voluntarily changes jobs, works low-wage jobs full-time, or has fluctuating work hours. Family instability is linked to problem behaviors and some academic outcomes, even at early ages. Children's problem behaviors further increase with multiple changes in family structure. Family transitions that occur early in children's development, prior to age 6, and in adolescence, appear to have the strongest effects. While young children need constant caregivers with whom they can form secure attachments, adolescents need parental support, role models, and continuity of residence and schools to succeed. Children demonstrate more negative behaviors when they lack the emotional and material support at home that they need to smoothly handle a family transition. Poverty is bad for children's emotional and cognitive development. and poverty is more likely to be the consequence of single-parent households. The next factor to consider is the subculture many of these young people are inculcated into. It should be no surprise that large numbers of delinquent, impoverished young men, with poor education and lacking in fatherly role models, would find acceptance within criminal gangs. In 2012, it was estimated that there were 30,000 gangs operating within the United States, with over 800,000 members. Blacks make up over 35% of these gangs, while whites make up less than 12%. These gangs are, of course, predominantly young men, and they are mostly located in large cities. Gang violence accounts for a hugely disproportionate amount of violent crime. Gangs are responsible for an average of 48% of violent crime in most jurisdictions, and up to 90% in several others. Major cities and suburban areas experience the most gang-related violence. Local, neighborhood-based gangs and drug crews continue to pose the most significant criminal threat in most communities. Aggressive recruitment of juveniles and immigrants, alliances and conflict between gangs, the release of incarcerated gang members from prison, advancements in technology and communication, and Mexican drug trafficking organization involvement in drug distribution have resulted in gang expansion and violence in a number of jurisdictions. As covered earlier, black people accounted for most of the arrests for murder at 51.3%, robbery at 55.9%, and gambling at 58.9%, and was significantly above average in several other categories. Weapons crimes at 40.7%, prostitution and vice at 41.8%, and aggravated assault at 33.1%. These are all common gang activities, and are without a doubt raising the resulting statistics for black crime. You may have noticed that the statistics for black crime have often been juxtaposed against Hispanic crime, with Hispanics having a higher rate of poverty and criminal gang membership, but a lower propensity for violence. I think this can be adequately explained by a lower rate of single-parent families, 31.2%, and a strong cultural tradition of deep familial ties, but I do not have any data or studies to validate this. So, why do black people commit more crimes? To be specific, young black men commit more crimes, far more, than any other racial demographic. They are much more likely to come from an unstable, impoverished, single-parent, matriarchal household. They are more likely than young white men to lack a strong male role model. They are much more likely to seek acceptance in gang culture, leading to the acquisition of a criminal record, reducing employment prospects, and putting the individual into a downward spiral of poverty, which further incentivizes criminal behavior as a source of income. If you don't mind me speaking in more generalized terms and giving my opinions on the matter, it seems to me that these people are victims of circumstance. For many black men, the deck has already been stacked against them from their earliest days. They suffer from many societal handicaps that are beyond their control that directly affect their cognitive abilities and emotional well-being, and find themselves with reduced options from social stigma attached to poverty before any other factors need to be introduced. So I know what you're thinking. This is the white man's fault, isn't it? And the answer is no. There is no one group at which the finger can be pointed with any reliability to say, you did this. If I may conjecture, I think the fact that black people can be visually distinguished from white people has provided an intellectually lazy trap in which it's easy to fall. It's very convenient to self-validate by inventing excuses for one's own poor choices, to project the responsibility for them onto mythical concepts like white supremacy, and dismiss other successful black people as Uncle Toms. Not only does it allow one to place the blame on an entity that can never refuse it, but it also allows one to ignore convenient facts regarding the inconsistency of this white supremacy and its apparent concern with the welfare and social advancement of black people. So how can this be fixed? The good news about all of this is that it is completely within the power of black people to solve the problems plaguing the black community. The first and, in my opinion, most important step is to begin the process of rebuilding the nuclear family. This will provide emotional and financial stability to black children and their parents, and it will provide incentives for the parents to achieve and set a good example for their children to follow. It will require black parents to take personal responsibility for themselves and their children. Subsequently, in time, this will improve the reputation of these communities through the improved moral character that they will display. To put it simply, I am recommending the empowerment of the black community through their own force of action. The barrier to this is little more than the will to change on the part of the members of this community. Am I saying that there is no racism in the United States? No. Racism will always exist on an individual level, and some individuals who are racist will always end up working in structures of power. However, to clumsily paraphrase Thucydides, I think the current state of black communities can be explained without recourse to placing the blame on a remote and abstract concept such as racism when there are so many direct temporal explanations for the current state of affairs. This is not a dismissal of the many instances of police brutality and racial discrimination. These events occur with alarming frequency. However, they are also not a barrier to the solutions required to the current problems facing the black community in the United States.
All right, that was great, informative. Once again, welcome to the George Wilder Jr. Show. Happy 2017, everybody. All right, we're going to talk about the best movies of 2016. Now, this is not my pick, but, you know, a lot of these movies I'm about to sprout off, I haven't seen them, as most of them I haven't seen them, but I'm just telling you what is before me. Okay, the first movie they're saying is The Arrival with Amy Adams. Now, I've got some material here, some movies with her in them, starring in them. I didn't think she was that great. You know, I thought that she did the best she could. Some of the movies that I have by her and that I've seen her in, I always thought she could be a better actress if she had better material. But, you know, like I said before, I haven't seen The Arrival, so I'm not going to be critical on it. But I'm just saying that this is what a lot of the critics are saying, that Arrival, starring Amy Adams, is one of the best movies of 2016. I haven't seen it. Okay, the next movie that they say is, and I do have this movie, Captain America, Civil War. Now, they are saying that that's one of the best movies. I think any of these Marvel movies would be great movies if Robert Downey Jr. wasn't there. You know, he spoils it for me. I mean, I'm a big fan of Iron Man. I am not a fan of Robert Downey Jr. I am not a fan of Robert Downey Jr. I'm just not. But he's the guy who plays Iron Man. I am a big fan of Iron Man. Okay, when Robert Downey Jr. Becomes Iron Man, I'm all giddy, you know, because I love Iron Man. But when Robert Downey Jr. is not Iron Man and he's acting in a movie, I can't stand it. Because, you know, I mean, it's just me, okay? All right, they're saying that Captain America, Civil War is one of the best movies of the year. I think it's an okay movie. I did like it. I'll give it 3 stars, personally. You know, I don't think it's one of the best or greatest, but you know, it's okay. It's fine. If they say so, then they say so. I'll give it 3 stars myself. Okay, the next movie that they're saying is one of the best movies of 2016, which I haven't seen. It's called Everybody Wants Some. Now, that's a connotation you can take different ways. Everybody Wants Some. The next one is Hidden Figures. Okay, I haven't seen that one, so I can't really give you an idea how I feel about it. It looks like a pretty good movie. I can't really criticize something I haven't seen, okay? Or say that I like it if I haven't seen it. But the next movie is La La Land. Okay, starring Ryan Gosling. I've never been a Ryan Gosling fan, but I don't know. I haven't seen La La Land. It's a musical from what I hear. And hey, maybe I'll check it out and I'll give you my own personal review of it. Okay, the next movie is Manchester by the Sea with Casey Affleck. Now, this movie is getting all kinds of Oscar buzz, and I haven't seen it yet either. And you know what? A lot of these movies that I'm calling off that they're saying is the best movies of 2017, the best movies of 2016. A lot of these movies, or most of them, they don't make the money that the Marvel movies make. They don't make the money. They don't get the audience, but they get the Oscars for some reason, for good performances. And that's always been interesting to me, that a lot of these movies are win 10 Oscars, but do not make any money at the box office for some reason. And that goes for Manchester by the Sea. That goes for La La Land. That goes for a lot of other these great movies that they project to be great, but they don't make any money at the box office. They fail at the box office. The studio loses money. Okay, the next movie is an animated movie called Moana. Okay, it's animated. All righty. I don't know anything about that. They have a caption under that, but let's go to the next movie. And the next movie is Moonlight. Okay. Something to do with a drug dealer, or maybe. Okay, the next movie is Sing Street. All right, these are the movies that some critic is saying is among the 10 most best movies of 2016. Do you agree? Do I agree? I'm just calling them out, folks. The next movie is The Witch. I haven't heard of that one before, The Witch, but it may be a good movie. I can't really say it. I can't really criticize it. You can't really criticize something or say something good or bad about a movie if you have not seen it yet. So I'm not going to go there until I, actually have seen the movies. And then I will be back and give you guys a critique on it if you haven't your own already. All right. You've been listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show. It's 7:02 straight up Chicago time. Once again, I want to wish everybody a happy 2017. Have a safe and wonderful 2017. Listen to the show. Listen to my show. Always listen to my show. 347-857-1762. This show has great guests, great talk, and super entertainment on the George Wilder Jr. Show. This is the talk of our times. This show is going into 2017 on a high note. Thanks, everybody. That is so true. I mean, because I wouldn't be here, folks, if it wasn't for you, because I have to know there's somebody out there that's supporting the show, that's listening to the show, that loves the show. This keeps me going all the time. This keeps me here. I'm not here because I want to be here. I'm not here because it's about money or it's about fame or it's about, getting me noticed. No, it's not that, because I don't need any of that. Money probably, but seriously, I don't need any of that. I just need people to listen, and I thank you for that. Okay, I learned that courage was not the absence of fear, but the triumph over it. Okay, all righty, the best of the holidays. You're listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show. We will be right back, folks.
The George Wilder Jr. Show is now on the air.
I'm here today to talk about a disturbing question, which has an equally disturbing answer. My topic is the secrets of domestic violence. And the question I'm going to tackle is the one question everyone always asks. Why does she stay? Why would anyone stay with a man who beats her? I'm not a psychiatrist, a social worker, or an expert in domestic violence. I'm just one woman with a story to tell. I was 22. I had just graduated from Harvard College. I'd moved to New York City for my first job as a writer and editor at 17 Magazine. I had my first apartment, my first little green American Express card, and I had a very big secret. My secret was that I had this gun loaded with hollow point bullets pointed at my head by the man who I thought was my soulmate many, many times. The man who I loved more than anybody on earth held a gun to my head and threatened to kill me more times than I can even remember. I'm here to tell you the story of crazy love, a psychological trap disguised as love, one that millions of women and even a few men fall into every year. It may even be your story. I don't look like a typical domestic violence survivor. I have a BA in English from Harvard College, an MBA in marketing from Wharton Business School. I spent most of my career working for Fortune 500 companies, including Johnson & Johnson, Leo Burnett, and The Washington Post. I've been married for almost 20 years to my second husband, and we have three kids together. My dog is a black lab, and I drive a Honda Odyssey minivan. So my first message for you is that domestic violence happens to everyone. All races, all religions, all income and education levels. It's everywhere. And my second message is that everyone thinks domestic violence happens to women, that it's a women's issue. Not exactly. Over 85% of abusers are men. And domestic abuse happens only in intimate, interdependent, long-term relationships. In other words, in families. The last place we would want or expect to find violence, which is one reason domestic abuse is so confusing. I would have told you myself that I was the last person on earth who would stay with a man who beats me. But in fact, I was a very typical victim because of my age. I was 22. And in the United States, women ages 16 to 24 are three times as likely to be domestic violence victims as women of other ages. And over 500 women and girls this age are killed every year by abusive partners, boyfriends, and husbands in the United States. I was also a very typical victim because I knew nothing about domestic violence, its warning signs, or its patterns. I met Connor on a cold, rainy January night. He sat next to me on the New York City subway, and he started chatting me up. He told me two things. One was that he, too, had just graduated from an Ivy League school, and that he worked at a very impressive Wall Street bank. But what made the biggest impression on me that first meeting was that he was smart and funny, and he looked like a farm boy. He had these big cheeks, these big apple cheeks, and this wheat blonde hair, and he seemed so sweet. One of the smartest things Connor did from the very beginning was to create the illusion that I was the dominant partner in the relationship. He did this, especially at the beginning, by idolizing me. We started dating, and he loved everything about me, that I was smart, that I'd gone to Harvard, that I was passionate about helping teenage girls and my job. He wanted to know everything about my family and my childhood, my hopes and dreams. Connor believed in me as a writer and a woman in a way that no one else ever had. And he also created a magical atmosphere of trust between us by confessing his secret, which was that as a very young boy, starting at age 4, he had been savagely and repeatedly physically abused by his stepfather. And the abuse had gotten so bad that he had had to drop out of school in 8th grade, even though he was very smart. And he'd spent almost 20 years rebuilding his life, which is why that Ivy League degree and the Wall Street job and his bright, shiny future meant so much to him. If you had told me that this smart, funny, sensitive man who adored me would one day dictate whether or not I wore makeup, how short my skirts were, where I lived, what jobs I took, who my friends were, and where I spent Christmas, I would have laughed at you, because there was not a hint of violence or control or anger in Connor at the beginning. I didn't know that the first stage in any domestic violence relationship is to seduce and charm the victim. I also didn't know that the second step is to isolate the victim. Now, Connor did not come home one day and announce, you know, hey, all this Romeo and Juliet stuff has been great, but I need to move into the next phase where I isolate you and I abuse you. So I need to get you out of this apartment where the neighbors can hear you scream and out of this city where you have friends and family and coworkers who can see the bruises. Instead, Connor came home one Friday evening and he told me that he had quit his job that day, his dream job. And he said that he had quit his job because of me, because I had made him feel so safe and loved that he didn't need to prove himself on Wall Street anymore. And he just wanted to get out of the city and away from his abusive, dysfunctional family and move to a tiny town in New England where he could start his life over with me by his side. Now, the last thing I wanted to do was leave New York and my dream job. But I thought you made sacrifices for your soulmate. So I agreed, and I quit my job, and Connor and I left Manhattan together. I had no idea I was falling into crazy love, that I was walking headfirst into a carefully laid physical, financial, and psychological trap. The next step in the domestic violence pattern is to introduce the threat of violence and see how she reacts. And here's where those guns come in. As soon as we moved to New England, you know, that place where Connor was supposed to feel so safe, he bought 3 guns. He kept one in the glove compartment of our car. He kept one under the pillows on our bed. And the third one he kept in his pocket at all times. And he said that he needed those guns because of the trauma he'd experienced as a young boy. He needed them to feel protected. But those guns were really a message for me. And even though he hadn't raised a hand to me, my life was already in grave danger every minute of every day. Connor first physically attacked me 5 days before our wedding. It was 7 a.m. I still had on my nightgown. I was working on my computer trying to finish a freelance writing assignment, and I got frustrated. And Connor used my anger as an excuse to put both of his hands around my neck and to squeeze so tightly that I could not breathe or scream. And he used the chokehold to hit my head repeatedly against the wall. 5 days later, the 10 bruises on my neck had just faded, and I put on my mother's wedding dress, and I married him. Despite what had happened, I was sure we were going to live happily ever after, because I loved him, and he loved me so much. And he was very, very sorry. He had just been really stressed out by the wedding and by becoming a family with me. It was an isolated incident, and he was never going to hurt me again. It happened twice more on the honeymoon. The first time, I was driving to find a secret beach, and I got lost. And he punched me in the side of my head so hard that the other side of my head repeatedly hit the driver's side window. And then a few days later, driving home from our honeymoon, he got frustrated by traffic, and he threw a cold Big Mac in my face. Connor proceeded to beat me once or twice a week for the next 2.5 years of our marriage. I was mistaken in thinking that I was unique and alone in this situation. 1 in 3 American women experiences domestic violence or stalking at some point in her life. And the CDC reports that 15 million children are abused every year. 15 million. So actually, I was in very good company. Back to my question. Why did I stay? The answer is easy. I didn't know he was abusing me. Even though he held those loaded guns to my head, pushed me downstairs, threatened to kill our dog, pulled the key out of the car ignition as I drove down the highway, poured coffee grinds on my head as I dressed for a job interview, I never once thought of myself as a battered wife. Instead, I was a very strong woman in love with a deeply troubled man, and I was the only person on earth who could help Connor face his demons. The other question everybody asks is, why doesn't she just leave? Why didn't I walk out? I could have left any time. To me, this is the saddest and most painful question that people ask, because we victims know something you usually don't. It's incredibly dangerous to leave an abuser, because the final step in the domestic violence pattern is kill her. Over 70% of domestic violence murders happen after the victim has ended the relationship, after she's gotten out, because then the abuser has nothing left to lose. Other outcomes include long-term stalking, even after the abuser remarries, denial of financial resources, and manipulation of the family court system to terrify the victim and her children, who are regularly forced by family court judges to spend unsupervised time with the man who beat their mother. And still we ask, why doesn't she just leave? I was able to leave because of one final sadistic beating that broke through my denial. I realized that the man who I loved so much was going to kill me if I let him. So I broke the silence. I told everyone. The police, my neighbors, my friends and family, total strangers. And I'm here today because you all helped me. We tend to stereotype victims as grisly headlines, self-destructive women, damaged goods. The question, why does she stay, is code for some people for it's her fault for staying, as if victims intentionally choose to fall in love with men intent upon destroying us. But since publishing Crazy Love, I have heard hundreds of stories from men and women who also got out, who learned an invaluable life lesson from what happened, and who rebuilt lives, joyous, happy lives, as employees, wives, and mothers, lives completely free of violence. Like me, because it turns out that I'm actually a very typical domestic violence victim and a typical domestic violence survivor. I remarried a kind and gentle man. We have those three kids. I have that black lab, and I have that minivan. What I will never have again, ever, is a loaded gun held to my head by someone who says that he loves me. Now, right now, maybe you're thinking, wow, this is fascinating. Or, wow, how stupid was she? But this whole time, I've actually been talking about you. I promise you, there are several people listening to me right now who are currently being abused, or who were abused as children, or who are abusers themselves. Abuse could be affecting your daughter, your sister, your best friend right now. I was able to end my own crazy love story by breaking the silence. I'm still breaking the silence today. It's my way of helping other victims. And it's my final request of you. Talk about what you heard here. Abuse thrives only in silence. You have the power to end domestic violence simply by shining a spotlight on it. We victims need everyone. We need every one of you to understand the secrets of domestic violence. Show abuse the light of day by talking about it with your children, your coworkers, your friends and family. Recast survivors as wonderful, lovable people with full futures. Recognize the early signs of violence and conscientiously intervene, de-escalate it, show victims a safe way out. Together, we can make our beds, our dinner tables, and our families the safe and peaceful oases they should be. Thank you.
All right, that was great. That was great. That was on domestic violence, and I always have her on the show so she can explain that. That's a clip. But every now and then we will play that, and some great information in there. That's why I keep it. And I am an advocate against domestic violence because it's all over the world. It's affecting too many people. And there's just too many people out there who are just letting this kind of thing just go on and on and on without contacting anybody, without, saying anything about what's going on. And so many people need to be educated. There's so many people out there who are uneducated about domestic violence, especially the people who are a part of it. You know, they're a part of it. I mean, it's rampant. It's everywhere. It doesn't matter if the woman brings it, if the woman or the girl brings it on themselves, it's wrong, period. It's something that shouldn't happen. Maybe they should be educated about domestic violence. If you see something, you know something, tell somebody. Don't just stand there and get your ass beat. Do something, say something. All right, and go by my website on Amazon. And put my name up there in the address bar. And I've written quite extensively about it. I've fictionalized it in some instances. There's some great information in some of those short stories that I do on domestic violence. I do it in a humorous way. I fictionalize it. I put it in a story format. So it'll be amusing and somewhat sad. But, you know, I'm pretty sure there is somebody out here in the world somewhere who knows someone who has been a victim of domestic violence. Maybe you have been a victim of domestic violence at one point in your life. Maybe you know someone who've been a victim of domestic violence. It's everywhere. I grew up with it. You know, I grew up with it, and that's why I'm such an advocate against it. And if you're in a relationship and this is happening to you, get out of it. Don't be stupid and dumb and stay in it and figure that and start to think that it's your fault, that you've done something to cause this. You've done nothing. But it will keep going. He or she will keep doing it until something is done. And most of the time, women who do not report domestic violence and just let it persist, that's a danger. You don't let domestic violence persist, because if you let it persist, it's only going to get worse. He's going to kill you if you do not get out of the situation, if you do not tell someone what you're going through, if you do not take a stand and put a stop to it. It's only you can do it. If you're going through it, if you know someone else that's going through it, your sister may be going through it, your nephew, anybody can be a victim of domestic violence. If you don't hear something, you have to report it. You have to say something, or you could be killed. I mean, abusers, they will not stop. They will keep going. Don't even think about a restraining order. They never work. They never work. See something, say something, report it.
burn up the roses if the bombs begin to fall. Heaven help the black man if he struggles one more day. Heaven help the white man if he turns back away. Heaven help the man who kicks the man who has a crawl. Heaven help us all.
All right. Happy New Year, everybody. Happy New Year. And that's coming from the George Wilder Jr. Show, broadcasting live out of the city of Chicago. It is just about, we got about a little over a minute left into the show. And as always, I want to say, have a great 2017 and make sure you keep yourself safe. And it seems. I'm thinking that 2017 is going to be a lot more exciting than 2016. Of course, 2016, we've had a lot of deaths, a lot of pretty death. And it's just been too painful, too much, and just awful. So a lot of us are saying good riddance with 2016, you know, but, you know, those of us who managed to get out of this. So have a great 20. I'll be back on the show tomorrow. I'm going to say the same thing, folks. So I hope you join me tomorrow. It's going to be another great show. We're going to have another great guest. And we're going to find out what's on this guest's mind. What can she tell us or he tell us that's going to make our lives a little bit better. But anyway, it's great. It's great being with you. I hope you guys join me tomorrow. Bye-bye, everybody. Take care.